This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson, visiting Houston Public Media. We rely on government to do the things we cannot do for ourselves, especially when disaster strikes.
A monster named Harvey is creeping up on the Gulf Coast of Texas.
Hurricane Harvey barreling into the Texas coastline as a Category 4 storm with 130-mile-an-hour winds.
Houston is a city in crisis. Millions waking up to a scene of epic flooding.
People trapped in their flooded-out homes. They are fleeing to their attics, taking to social media, begging for a rescue.
Water's so high, the boats are going over top of cars.
Shelters are overflowing with evacuees.
This storm in Houston has produced the largest rainfall amount from a single storm that has ever been recorded in the continental United States.
In August 2017, Hurricane Harvey devastated this region and killed 68 people. Adjusted for inflation, it is the second costliest hurricane on record, just behind Hurricane Katrina. No wonder so much money was set aside for recovery. But a recent report from the Government Accountability Office, that's the investigative arm of Congress, shows that billions of dollars for 2017's major hurricanes have barely been spent. That includes money for Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, by the way. According to the GAO, the federal government set aside $5 billion for Texas in 2017. But this state has only used about $18 million of that, mostly due to bureaucratic red tape. Disaster aid has the potential to affect every American, including those in the Midwest now recovering from historic flooding. How well is government working for us? What's gone right and wrong in Houston? And how does that change the politics of people in the disaster zone? Joining us here at Houston Public Media is its politics and government reporter, Andrew Schneider. Andrew, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me.
We also welcome your questions and thoughts from across the country, or if you're here listening to us on News 88.7 in the Houston area, about your experiences dealing with government aid after disaster strikes. So email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Andrew Schneider, how's Houston doing right now in terms of recovery?
Well, you fly into the city or you take time to go through downtown, and you would think that nothing serious had happened here. But then you go out to the individual neighborhoods, you know, particularly places on the to the west of the city, which were flooded very badly due to the release of the reservoirs, or areas, you know, closer to the many bayous that honeycomb the city. And a lot of people have not seen any help whatsoever. You would walk into their house and you'd think that the flood had just happened.
And we'll talk to one resident who lives in the western part of Houston in just a moment. But that's an interesting point that you make, Andrew, that the geography of the city played a big role in terms of how well or how poorly people have recovered since Harvey.
Exactly. I mean, this is a city before Harvey, you know, the joke was Houston was built on a swamp, and that was just the way people got through the summer because it's hot and humid here. We're based right in the Gulf of Mexico. But the reality is that Houston historically was built on marshland, and we are cut through with many, many, many miles of bayous and rivers and streams and artificial channels. And, you know, because Houston is built out without any kind of zoning ordinance, there's really a lot less protection than you might hope in a situation like that.
You recently visited a family that's still living in a stripped down home in southeast Houston that basically in some parts, some of these homes still look like they've been ripped down to the studs and never been rebuilt. I want you to tell me about the Torres family. But first, here's a clip of some of what they went through during Hurricane Harvey.
Panic came in quick and fast as the floodwaters. And it was just coming in, and then we remembered the dogs that were outside. And I had a Weimaraner and a little mutt dog. Samba was in a chair, but Ryo was like neck deep. I was like, oh my gosh. So we brought him in, and Ryo didn't make it.
So clearly the Torres family has been through a lot. Tell us about what else they've been through.
Well, Alice and Dolores Torres, Alice lives with a great deal of health difficulties. She was on an oxygen machine, tethered to a machine in her bedroom the entire time I was there. Her mother's in her 80s. Both of them suffer from diabetes. They were essentially trapped in their house during Hurricane Harvey. They had a culvert running through their backyard where the water was 8 feet deep. The water came in their house 3 feet deep, and it rotted everything right down to the ground. They've had virtually no help. The insurance company that that they worked with did not provide them with, they said, the help that they needed. And the contractor that they brought in left them after doing very little work. And so they've been living in a house with very little work in it for the past year and a half.
We're speaking to Houston Public Media's politics and government reporter Andrew Schneider. Andrew, the Texas legislature, as I understand it, is working on a few bills right now related to relief from Harvey. What would they do? How are they targeted?
Well, the most significant of the bills would create a revolving infrastructure fund of about $3 billion. This would tap the state's emergency reserve, known colloquially as the Rainy Day Fund. And what it would do would be to provide resources for local governments to rebuild damaged areas, but also to create new flood control infrastructure in order to protect against future disasters.
There's also some debate as to how much government should be doing after a disaster. You know, the common wisdom is that you should be prepared to fend for yourself for the first 3 days of a disaster. Gretchen emailed, "The government's role after a natural disaster is temporary. It is for emergency rescue and assistance, not ongoing, unending support. The government cannot make people whole after a disaster." Andrew Schneider, how much does Gretchen's sentiment reflect any of the conversation here in Texas?
I think it varies depending on who you speak with. I mean, a lot of the people felt that the disaster that they suffered was in part caused by the government because of poor management, poor preparation, because of the lack of zoning, because of failure to provide for significant infrastructure, in some cases building infrastructure that was flawed and directed the water towards their homes. And if the government, if they hold the government itself responsible for the disaster through either incompetence or inefficiency, then they're going to look to the government to solve the problem they created.
That kind of gets to Brad's comment. Brad emailed, "The problem is what the city did prior to the hurricane. Houston sits on top of several creeks that drain naturally into the Gulf. With the massive building that has occurred over the last 10 years, developers were sloppy and didn't consider draining. It's all concrete now." Let me play another clip from the Torreses. They say they've started to lose faith in government because of this process. Here is some of Alice Torres venting about the government's lack of help.
"Where were you when the contractor took our money and didn't come back? Where were you when we needed assistance? This is not a unique story. This is happening across Houston. I don't know if the people on the other side of town, the wealthier people, got more help or what came through the same issues we have, but I know in this community, the help has not been here at all."
Well, we'll meet some people on the other side of town in just a moment. But Andrew, tell us more about what the Torreses went through, especially in terms of visiting Houston City Council meetings and just watching the politics of disaster relief play out.
Well, the Torreses were one of many families that have appeared at the Houston City Council meetings on a regular basis and have been taken aside at the end of their presentation. And in this case, Dolores Torres spoke with the mayor, and the mayor said, "We're going to make sure that this is taken care of." Obviously, it still hasn't. I should say that the way that I first became acquainted with the Torrances, the Torreses, was through their member of City Council. He pointed me to them and to their plight as an example of people who are still suffering a year and a half afterwards. So it's not like they're not aware of the problem. Their ability to deal with the problem, though, is they've been completely overwhelmed.
So what exactly is the problem? Is it a lack of funding? Is it bureaucratic red tape? Like, what's the holdup?
I think it's a combination of different things. I mean, from the very beginning, the members of Houston City Council recognized that regardless of who was at fault, they were the closest to the problem. And so they were the ones who were going to get blamed. And so They've regularly been making trips to Congress. They've regularly been meeting with members of the administration. They've been going to Austin and meeting with the governor, trying to get the message across that no matter how fast the aid is coming, it's not coming fast enough. We've had holdups in terms of the General Land Office, which is the office at the state level here in Texas, to which the federal funding is being directed before being sent down to the local governments. We've had problems at the federal level, particularly in terms of housing and urban development and the Office of Management and Budget in the White House in terms of setting the rules for how this money is spent. It all comes together and creates, as you said, a lot of red tape.
Before I have to let you go, what sense do you have of how Hurricane Harvey has affected politics here in Houston? Recovery was very much a campaign issue in 2018. Is it still an issue? Is it expected to affect, say, voter turnout?
I think it's an indirect issue. We had, even before Harvey, a labor management struggle that was going on with the fire department here, with the firefighters trying to get their pay equalized to the level of police. And when that didn't happen fast enough, they took a measure to the voters, put it as a ballot initiative this past November. And the voters passed that overwhelmingly simply because they saw the firefighters as heroes. Now the mayor is not moving fast enough, and they're getting a sense that this is likely to be an issue on the campaign trail this November as well.
Andrew Schneider, politics and government reporter for Houston Public Media. Andrew, thanks for talking to us.
You're welcome.
Coming up, we'll visit a neighborhood in West Houston that's still recovering from Hurricane Harvey's massive flooding. We'll try to get to some more of your questions as well. Michael emailed, private insurance is very expensive on floodplains. Common sense dictates that there are places that are not suitable for building homes. Why should taxpayers come to the rescue of people who choose to live in these places? Interesting question. We'll see if we can get you some answers. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
We have got so many families still with kids, a 94-year-old lady, some single older women here. We really need to have rescue teams here. We only have two Coast Guard boats. We've got people that need to be rescued. If you're hearing this, call and report this, please, so they could get rescue crews here to help. We don't have enough.
This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Houston, and that was part of a video shot by Carrie Yanashanis during Hurricane Harvey. Emergency lines were clogged, and so she turned to Facebook Live to get some help. Yanashanis is a social worker. She lives on the west side of Houston in a neighborhood called the Memorial Area. We visited her at home in Houston yesterday. Now, her house is mostly repaired, but many of her neighbors' homes are still partially in ruins.
You're going to find this really ironic, is this door, which I adore. We just got a note from the HOA that they don't like my door. And I'm like, so the house over there is in studs. The house behind us, step down, just got started mold removal. I just found out yesterday. And so it's been sitting there for 18 months with no mold removal. So I had to call the health inspector on the house back there. I was like, okay, so the HOA is literally picking up on the color of my door, but the rest of the house is, you know, the neighborhood's in disaster.
The Army Corps of Engineers intentionally flooded this neighborhood during Hurricane Harvey to prevent downtown Houston from going deeper underwater. Now, Yanashana says she understands the decision was made for the greater good, but she and her neighbors have been abandoned by local and federal government. They've been repeatedly denied aid. They've gotten frustrated at bureaucratic red tape tying up disaster relief funds. Now, Yanashanis' circumstances are unique, but her struggle to get federal aid is not. Here's part of our conversation with her about this struggle. Carrie Yanashanis, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for having me.
What's your most vivid memory of Hurricane Harvey?
Most vivid memory, I think, is the first morning when they had opened the dam and there is water all over the street and we have no rescue boats. And I'm just focused on how am I going to help my neighbors escape.
I understand you helped rescue quite a few people after Harvey, right?
Yes, I did. I was part of an all-volunteer group. Basically, we're all
first responders, but we're not trained to be first responders, but we didn't have any other professional first responders that could get to our neighborhood. So it started off with just some neighbors helping neighbors. We started off having inflatable kayaks and rafts from pools. And then my friend Javier, he had two kayaks, hard kayaks. So we were able to start rescuing people on that. I did a Facebook Live shout out. I think that got some other volunteers to come. And then word got out that our section of Houston really needed help. So people who had boats all of a sudden were coming in with boats and jet skis. And by the end of the day, or the end of, it was like a three-day hurdle rescuing people. But by the end of that, I mean, we had proper boats. The water was so deep. We had proper boats sailing down the middle of our street, getting people out.
That must have been kind of a surreal moment, kind of realizing that the need is that great and the kinds of people you would expect to come rescue you, they may not be there anytime soon.
No, and in fact, they were a mile and a half, the FEMA rescue crews, and I think it was also the National Guard, they were set up a mile and a half at Stratford High School, and they actually got evacuated. They evacuated past all of us. And so all of the emergency vehicles evacuated and left us here. And then that night they opened the dam.
There's a mark by your front door that says waterline.
Yes, I put that there. Actually, just drew that there. I wanted to show you the water was 4 feet in our house for about almost a little bit over 2 weeks. But in the street, it was over our head. So we had proper boats in this neighborhood with engines zooming through trying to get people.
As far as your neighbors, who's recovered, who's not? Like, how's the neighborhood now?
So it was interesting you say that because I was just sitting where you are and I was looking around just from this perspective, kind of a circle around my house. That house right there has just now, 18 months later, it's starting to get mold remediated. I don't even know what is inside that house, but it's toxic. That house right there is abandoned. The house next to us here, they did, they remodeled it and rebuilt it, and they're trying to sell it. Across the street was a 94-year-old man, and he obviously had to walk away from the house. He wasn't in any state to be able to repair it. That neighbor's staying, that neighbor's gone, and the neighbor next door, they're down to the studs, and they're just trying to get rid of it.
So really,
there's just one neighbor across the street.
Yeah. So I imagine that it's almost like a patchwork in terms of who's able to stay, who's able to go, who's able to rebuild, who's still stuck. I'm guessing that different neighbors face different kinds of challenges and setbacks that affected whether they could recover and how well they recovered.
Yes. And I kind of compare it to a family tree. If you look at Houston, right, Houston flooded, it's at the top. And then you start to have these divisions. You have Houston flooded. Okay, did your house flood or did you not flood? The people who didn't flood started to have this survivor's guilt. And so they had their own set of struggles. People who flooded, we kind of divided into two different branches of those with insurance, those without. And then the ones without insurance, it's another subdivision of could you get an SBA loan? Could you not get an SBA loan? Were you able to get Habitat help, not get Habitat help? So while we're all in the same community, we're all in very different, everybody's narrative is very individual.
Let me play a sound clip from one of your neighbors. His name is David. Here's something he said to us while we were touring his home. Listen.
We worked our entire lives. We put ourselves through night school, getting our graduate degrees. We've worked hard. We started at entry-level positions and worked our way up, and our American dream was to have our government flood us out and then leave us behind. We had two senators in Texas. I reached out to both of them for assistance. One responded. I voted for him. One did not. I will not vote for him. They're of the same political party. Red or blue, I have no bias either way. Except for who is representing us. I'll tell you, I will not vote for our commissioners when they come up for re-election because they did absolutely nothing to look out for their constituents.
So that was David, one of your neighbors. I know that it borders on being a little crass talking about who you're voting for when there's something so much bigger like your home being flooded out. But I understand where David's coming from. Has any of that sort of thought crossed your mind as well in terms of holding your elected officials accountable for what they did or did not do?
Yes. Absolutely. And I would say I do agree with David. This has made me more conscious of local government. For example, one of the so there's this block grant that just came through, and it's, I think, $1.2 billion. The money came through. We heard that Houston was going to get this $1.2 billion grant to help all of us. And then we heard they were going to give it to the city of Houston, and they would be in charge of distributing it. And for those of us who have already been here, having to deal with the city of Houston, and we just keep getting knocked down and not able to get anywhere with them. For us, it was awful to know that they're going to be in charge of distributing this money. I think a lot of us would have preferred it could have been the state, or it could have been federal aid given out as opposed to given to the local government.
So the issue was that it went through another set of hands, that it didn't just go from the federal government to you. It went from the federal government to Houston, and the federal government said, Houston, handle this.
Yes. So Houston is in charge of distributing it. But when you've already been here and you've not been able to get any aid at all through your community, the only aid we've gotten has been through churches. Every single wall in this house was donated by a church, literally.
Donated the walls.
They donated all the drywall. And what you don't realize is in between the drywall, you have to have insulation. You have to have a vapor barrier. So those churches all got together and donated all of the drywall for us. And then we got the workers to put it up. And we had neighbors helping us put it up. And my husband did most of the insulation rebuild. So we didn't have governmental aid. We didn't have any of that. We had, for example, after the flood, we didn't have any FEMA workers here to even help us gut houses or anything like that, or any real advice of how to gut out a house. I mean, would you know how to gut out a house if you've had 4 feet of raw sewage, fish, and gasoline in your house? So we had Mormons coming in from Austin to help volunteer gutting out our houses, and they came weekend after weekend after weekend, and yet we still didn't have any governmental support.
I imagine there's kind of two lines of thought going through your head as all this is happening. One is, well, where is the city of Houston where I need you? Like, I'm a voter and a citizen and a property taxpayer. Where are you? And on the other hand, it's like, wow, all these people kind of showed up to help and to fill the gap.
Absolutely. And it puts you in a double bind. So I'm a social worker, and it puts people in a double bind because you have all these wonderful people coming out and helping you. And then you feel like you don't have the right to complain that your government's not stepping up. So you have all these people giving from their heart, and then you don't want to bring negativity into the situation. But the reality is we got through this because of our community, because of our neighbors, because of people who we didn't even know that came in with swamp boats, you know, like vehicles that you wouldn't even expect to see coming in to help us and help us recover. And just from the gutting out of the house, but even to the rebuild, you know, people coming and helping put walls up.
Now, there is a more libertarian line of thought that would say that that's exactly the way it should work, that government, that disaster response is something that should be vested first in communities, neighbors, churches, and that the government's role should be much more hands-off, that what you experienced through donations, through the goodness of people's hearts, is the way that it should be.
So, yes, I would agree that there is that libertarian view. However, what's different about our area of Houston is that the government chose to flood us. We did not flood because of Hurricane Harvey. We were dry. It's that at 9 o'clock at night, the government chose to shut off our electricity. And at 1 o'clock in the morning, they chose to do an uncontrolled release of the dam into our neighborhood. And people died. That's not for the community to fix. That's on the government's hands. My friend Kyle, he was out of town. His husband drowned in his house, and it took scuba divers finding his body. So that's the reality. That falls on the government. That doesn't fall on us citizens. That's on the government. That's on their shoulders that they not only stole our property, but they took lives.
How does this affect your overall trust in government after going through all of this?
I'm very cynical. Very cynical. It's hard to know that your husband gave 20 years of his life to the military, to the government, and they can do something like this and then not support you afterwards. I understand if they had to flood us for the greater good of Houston, but then to be left to fend for ourselves. There were no veterans programs to come in and help vets. You know, he's a retired pilot from the U.S. Air Force. How are there no programs to help vets who have gone through catastrophic loss? My mom was a federal judge. She was an ALJ, an administrative law judge. My dad was 20 years Army. He has two Purple Hearts and a Silver Star. I'm a social worker. I give to the community. It's hard to know that coming from a family perspective of people who have given their lives in service to our country can be just left like that. And so it's made me very cynical of the government.
Did this storm impact your views on climate change at all?
So I'm a swimmer, and I would always think of, you know, there's plastics in the water, things like that, or I would think of climate change and emissions, you know, from cars. But with Harvey, the land behind the dam was supposed to be a retaining pond, and then the government sold those plots off to builders who built subdivisions. So there was no longer any retaining pond for that water to absorb into. So that human element, we went in and we've destroyed this nature, and we destroyed the integrity of the dam by building back there. You know, I mean, you can call it greed, you could call it whatever you want, but ultimately, we now have a town that is unable, it doesn't have the infrastructure to handle this extreme weather that we're having.
With so many different people in so many different stages of recovery or non-recovery going through all this trauma, how do you go through this without losing your mind? I mean, how have people here just coped emotionally, spiritually, without just, you know, throwing themselves in the floodwaters and saying to hell with it? How do you go through this without losing your mind?
I think that's a great question. And I will tell you, I think a lot of people have. They've gone through severe depression. They've gone through PTSD. There's been parents who have been so traumatized by this that they can't be there for their kids fully. There's kids that now have emotional problems that never did before. It's hard. I know for me, one of the things that got me through it was I'm an open water swimmer, and that's part of my identity. And I know I can do hard things. And I would come back, and some days I would say, Carrie, you swam 20 miles. You swam the Catalina Channel. You can do hard things. You can do this. And that was kind of my mantra. I can do hard things. And I think that the people who have been able to move forward, it's been with the support of the community, but it's also, you know, as a therapist, I think you have to tap into what have you done that's been hard before? Remind yourself you can do it, and then you build from there.
If there's one thing, before I let you go, that would be at the top of your list of things that either the city of Houston, the state of Texas, or the federal government could do to redeem themselves from what you didn't get enough of, didn't get properly, went to the wrong place, came at the wrong time. If there's one thing at the top of that list to try to begin to make amends for this, mm-hmm. What's at the top of the list?
That idea of getting some sort of reimbursement to kind of help create the safety net underneath us, because we've borrowed money from friends, credit cards are maxed out. We've taken loans just to get ourselves to a space of some normality. But then on the emotional element, you know, what's the highest for me is it's really hard to be in a city and not have people say, thank you. Your neighborhood, you were the sacrificial lamb for Houston. We flooded you guys to save downtown and to save other areas of Houston. I would love a thank you. Right? I mean, there were times right after the flood where I would go into these neighborhoods that hadn't been flooded, and I would think, why aren't people thanking us? They need to thank us. Like, our lives are destroyed to save theirs and to save downtown. And I would love a thank you for that. But I also know the dichotomy there is that we live in a really unjust world. And there are people every single day that live in unjust communities, and they will never get that apology. So you say to me, like, what's at the top of the list? I think if I were to get that, I would feel like the luckiest person in the world. I really would, because most people never will.
Carrie Yanishanis, I appreciate you bringing us in your home and telling us your story. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
We reached out to the Army Corps of Engineers to respond to the lawsuit that Carrie and her neighbors have filed. The agency said in part, quote, as a matter of policy, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers does not comment on pending litigation, unquote. The Department of Justice also responded to our inquiry saying no comment. Coming up, where do you turn when the government turns its back on you? We'll get some answers in just a moment. Stay close. One A Across America is in Houston talking about the recovery from Hurricane Harvey. We want to know how these natural disasters shape political views and change voting patterns. We asked you to comment on that, and here is some of what you left in our inbox.
This is Diane in the Panhandle of Florida. There are approximately 10 counties that were hit by a near Category 5 hurricane 6 months ago, and we're still waiting for assistance from the federal government. We have people living in tents and people who have lost their jobs, and we need help.
My name is Sophia. I'm from the Rockaways. We were hit really badly by Superstorm Sandy and are still not home. There were a lot of people trying to help us that were trying to work within the system, but the way that the rules were written, it's just overwhelming. The recovery is worse than the disaster.
I'm Robert. I'm from Panama City, Florida. We are still in the recovery from Hurricane Michael, which was 6 months ago. But the recovery process has been very slow and very difficult. People are still living in tents. I think we need to have a national plan to respond to these natural disasters because we're able to do it, but we have to do it.
Thank you all for sharing your thoughts with us. Welcome more of them, 1A@WAMU.org. And clearly those of you who commented are starting to have some different perspectives in terms of the government and your trust in it. And that is what we want to discuss with our next guest, who's joining us from KUT Public Radio in Austin. Donald Kettle is the author of Can Governments Earn Our Trust? And he's also a professor at the University of Texas at Austin. Professor Kettle, nice to have you with us. Welcome.
It's great to be with you there, Joshua.
Your reactions to what we heard from Kerryana Shaunis and how common her situation is, particularly as it relates to her changing perceptions of government?
Yeah, it's just what a stunning story it is. And there are so many different pieces of it that are just so heartbreaking, but also deserve much broader attention to this. We have such high expectations for what we want government to do in the aftermath of a storm. We, on the other hand, have so much problem in trying to figure out how much capacity we want to build in government to do it and how much money we want to spend in the process. And underlying all this is the fact that FEMA is really a pretty tiny agency that can't and won't do very much itself. Its real job is to try to find ways of leveraging a much broader network, but that's where things end up in such trouble because there's so much work to be done and so few people to do it and so many people who suffer in the meantime. So it is such a heartbreaking, terrible, complex problem that gets to the heart of what we want government to do for us.
Well, a complex problem and also a complex problem that has to be solved by some fairly complex agencies. I mean, you're right that FEMA is not designed to like be the hero. It's almost like some people expect FEMA to be the truck that's carrying the aid, when in reality, and correct me if I'm wrong, Professor, FEMA is more like the traffic light system that tells the trucks where to go and gets them where they need to be.
It's or maybe an orchestra conductor that's in charge of making sure that when you need violins that maybe water supplies or you need cellos that can bring in the people with the boats, that they're the ones who are in charge of making sure that that happens. For the most part, this isn't FEMA water delivered by FEMA people. It's not FEMA boats driven by FEMA boat drivers. It's FEMA's job to try to orchestrate all this. Every disaster is different. Everyone creates such different kinds of problems. The one in Houston was so different and so complex because Houston is just so flat. So you get so much water that ends up falling so fast, there just wasn't any place for it to go. And then the Army Corps decided to deliberately flood some neighborhoods, as Carrie pointed out, to try to avoid even worse problems further on downstream. So you have all this all coming together. And it's worth pointing out as well that tomorrow you're going to be talking about the problems of immigration, but it's the same agency, Department of Health, of Homeland Security, rather. The Department of Homeland Security is in charge of both this and immigration issues, and so they've got this enormous problem of trying to balance all at the same time, to try to deal with today's immigration problems as well as the problems of trying to recover from what it is that Harvey did to Houston.
I wonder what your sense is, just kind of zooming out from this in particular, about how much we should reasonably trust our government to protect us from natural disasters and to help aid in the recovery. We got different perspectives from some of our listeners. Let me read two comments back to back. Steve in Peachtree, Georgia tweeted, "I can tell you with 20 years of local government experience that if you allow people to build in swamps, floodplains, and coastal areas, we should not be surprised when we see catastrophes like Houston experienced. It's not a federal government problem." Contrast that with a comment from Alan, who emailed, "The comment from the person who questions taxpayer support for flood victims is extremely selfish. Every part of this country is subject to some form of disaster. Flood, fire, hurricane, tornado." And to that list, Professor, I would add also earthquakes and droughts, all kinds of natural disasters. But what's your take? What is the right balance between what we should expect government to do in a disaster and what we should expect to do for ourselves?
And that's, in many ways, one of the toughest things that we have to try to deal with, because nobody likes big government. Nobody likes to have to pay for big government. Nobody likes to have to pay the cost of complying with government regulations. But when problems happen, there's just no response that can possibly be fast enough. And that's an impossible dilemma to have to try to deal with. In Houston in particular, one of the challenges was that the city has very, very loose zoning restrictions. And so people can pretty much do what they want, where they want. And that's one of the reasons why the land behind the dam, as we heard earlier, ended up being taken away as a place to catch all this water, because development was allowed to happen there. So if we allow people to do what they want, that ends up having consequences. And we often, on the one hand, want total freedom to do what we want and complete instantaneous reaction when problems happen. And the challenge there is trying to figure out how to balance that. But the bottom line is this, that when people are in trouble, one of the reasons why we have government, and this goes back thousands of years, is to make sure that government is there to help. It doesn't always mean that government itself has to do everything, but it does mean that government has to make sure that things get done. And that's one of the important distinctions between that, being able to bring nonprofits in, bring local government officials from other communities in to try to help, making sure the Red Cross is there, making sure that there are church groups that are coordinated. One of the things that government can do best is ensuring that the response that citizens need happen when it is that it has to happen. But at the same time, making sure that we think about this in advance, about having the capacity to respond, but also minimizing our risk by preventing people, perhaps by building where it is that they're going to put themselves in harm's way. There's one interesting story that often happens more often than in Florida than anything else, because they tend to have so many disasters, Joshua.
Right.
But there are some places where FEMA has come in and rebuilt the same home four or five times after disasters, because people keep coming in, finding them their house destroyed, saying, "I want help." They get the help. They rebuild it in the same place and ends up getting flooded out all over again. At some point, when do we say no? So we've got this challenge of figuring out, how much do we do? How much do we keep people from doing? How do we make sure that what has to get done gets done? And it is truly one of government's toughest problems.
We're speaking to Professor Donald Kettle of UT Austin. He's the author of Can Governments Earn Our Trust? Glad to get some comments from some of you who can empathize with what Kerry is dealing with. KT Morton emailed, "Kerry's situation is not unusual. Residents of Atascocita had the same situation 40 miles northeast of Houston. The county opened the floodgates, and that caused their houses to flood. Nothing is being done to prevent this problem. Every few months, we go to Houston and see more building, more houses, more cement, with no concern for future flooding for the safety of people and their possessions." Allison wrote on our Facebook page, "In a majority of the housing cases in floodplains, the people did not choose to be in a flood-prone area, nor would new construction allow for it under the law. The real issue is that the flood level keeps rising as a result of increased upstream impervious surface areas and global warming that is intensifying storms. Professor, I understand what Allison's saying. She's kind of making two points. One, that there's more impervious surface area, concrete, that prevents floodwaters from just sinking into the earth and it forces it to drain somewhere else. She also mentioned global warming, climate change. How do you see the impact of climate change on our trust in government?
Well, one of the things for sure here is that whether we think government has a role or not, we're going to have to keep coming back to this question. We're going to come to this question more often, and it's going to poke its head up in lots of ways where we least expect it, whether it's forest fires that burn towns in California, or whether it's floods in the middle of Nebraska, or whether it's the kind of situation that we see here in Houston. One way or another, the one thing that's clear is that there's more stuff that's happening. And the more stuff that's happening is going to cause more of these questions to come up. And as they do, we're going to have to think about how to get much better at dealing with these questions, which is, how much do we really want and the government to be involved in preventing this from happening by engaging in infrastructure improvements or by regulating where people can build? How much do we want to try to force people to rely more on the private sector by, for example, buying more flood insurance? How much do we, in the end, want to make sure the government's much more effective at orchestrating the response to some of these situations that are going to inevitably happen more often? So the one thing we have to do is get a whole lot smarter. And this means not only the federal government, but it means every local government around the country. Because, as you pointed out, Joshua, there isn't any place you can live that the community is not possibly susceptible to some kind of disaster of some kind. So that this has got to be first and foremost on the minds of every local government official, because every one of these things inevitably starts as a local problem to which the local governments have to be first and foremost on the scene.
Jan emailed, I live in Michigan, and I'm very fortunate to have very few natural disasters, let alone dealing with our government due to this. To the woman who shared this interview and her whole community, I apologize as a member of another community. Their lives are so damaged. She's right. There's many, many suffering people in our country. I think this story reflects that to all those in need. And Rubric tweeted, just got my kitchen back in action 2 weeks ago. Very slow process. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. So, Professor, how does this play out going forward, particularly in terms of the ballot box in 2020? We've got Democratic candidates who are vying to be the nominee, elections coming up in the next year or two. How much do these kinds of issues and the larger issues of trust in government play out at the ballot box?
You know, it's such a fascinating question because on the one hand, the thing, except at the local level, as we've heard here, except at the local level, I don't think I've heard any national candidates talking about this. When we're talking about climate change, we're not talking about how it may affect anybody wherever it is that they might live. And I suspect that at the broader national level, what we're going to see is very little conversation about this, even though it is the one thing that whoever wins the election as president is certain to face. More of these kinds of situations, from fires to floods to tornadoes to earthquakes, that it's just going to happen, which is the one thing we can be certain of. On the other hand, the question is, well, what do we want this person to do? And because it involves having to try to force people to do things they don't want to do, but on the other hand, inevitably leave people short when they need help, it's the kind of thing that in trying to build trust is one of those hardest things of all. It's clear that of all the broader challenges we've got with democracy, it's that people just don't trust government much to deliver. It's in part because of the expectations that we have, because we really want a lot of quick response and a lot of immediate help when these kinds of disasters happen. We don't want to have government tell us what to do. We don't want to have to pay higher taxes, but we are not very good about having conversations with ourselves about what it is we want government to do. So as a result, we have candidates so often that talk in only the broadest terms and not figuring out how it is that they're going to connect directly with us. There's, on the wholesale level, the problem of trust of, do we think Congress is going to work and can we deal with the problems of income inequality and the other really super big issues that tend to draw national debate? On the other hand, what really matters in terms of building trust in government is how these individual transactions, I've got a problem, is government there to help, or is government making sure that I get the help that I need? That's what it is that more than anything else people base their decisions about trust on. And we often have this mismatch between this broad national debate on the one hand and the kinds of very specific kinds of things that people want on the other. And it's something that government simply has got to get much better at.
Well, and also a lot of these issues are very politicized. Climate change is highly politicized. Disaster aid after Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico has become quite politicized. I got to let you go in a minute, Professor, but if there are any best practices, anything at the top of your list for governments to regain trust, particularly for trust in government in times of crisis, what's at the top of that list before I let you go?
The best thing of all is to know that it can be done and that the key is not to have government try to solve the problem itself, but to act as that orchestra conductor to get the problem solved. That's what Admiral Thad Allen did when he actually did exactly that after Katrina in New Orleans. We know how to do this. We just have to get much more practiced at figuring out how to do it much better and much faster. But good news is we know how to get this job done.
And does that include, how much does that include involving private sector, volunteers, nonprofits, insurance agencies, and so forth?
It involves all of that. It's government's job to try to figure out how to get all those things working together. One of the things that they discovered after Katrina was that instead of the government delivering supplies itself, there are places like Walmart and Home Depot that know how to deliver supplies because they're good at supply chain management.
Right.
So you let the people who are good at doing that figure out how to do it better and make sure that government can then step in to do what it is that nobody else has the authority or the power or the money to be able to do themselves.
UT Austin Professor Donald Kettle, his book is called Can Governments Earn Our Trust? Professor, thanks for talking to us.
So good to be with you, Joshua.
This conversation was produced by James Morrison. Special thanks to Houston Public Media for hosting us this week and for helping with the reporting and the research. 1A Across America is a collaboration funded in part by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. You can learn more and share your thoughts online at the1a.org/AcrossAmerica. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Joshua Johnson. This is 1A.